Yeah, let's get started with what Putin has put out before the summit in Switzerland. And he had some conditions, preconditions for any sort of peace talk that may happen in the future. How realistic are these conditions in your opinion? Are they practical?
Well, I mean, some people are characterizing his conditions as some kind of ultimatum, but it's not an ultimatum. It's a precondition for actually having detailed negotiations about a peace settlement. And those preconditions are is the basically twofold. One, I mean, firstly, that Ukraine has to agree to concede certain territories to to Russia. Territories which, by the way, Russia by and large occupies anyway, and the territory that they don't occupy at the moment, that Putin's demanding that Ukraine concede, that they will be occupying most of it anyway in the near future. So in a sense, that's not much of a concession to ask Ukraine to make. And then secondly, there's a demand for Ukraine's effectively Ukraine's neutralization. So that what Putin sees as the Russia, sorry, the Ukraine NATO threat to Russian security is liquidated once and for all. Okay, so those are the preconditions for a ceasefire, and then following the ceasefire there will be detailed negotiations about a peace settlement that Putin, he says in his speech, he wants it to be a permanent resolution of the conflict, not just just some kind of breathing space while both sides build up their forces for having another go at each other. Yeah. So pre-condo and in those negotiations, there will be lot many things to for the two sides to discuss and negotiate, including, of course, some kind of international security guarantee for Ukraine, so that Ukraine can be assured that if it agrees to be to demilitarize and to declare that it will no longer it won't aspire to join NATO, that it's security, its security, its sovereignty and territorial integrity, or at least what's left of it after it's conceded these territories to Russia, that will be guaranteed in the future. So it's not an ultimatum. It's a set of preconditions for negotiations, and actually, I would say they're quite moderate preconditions. What Putin is demanding is, I think, in effect, the minimum that he could demand. Right now, in making that demand, and his demands are not in any way surprising. What's the significance of the speech is that he spelt them out in detail, very, 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 very specific. But what Putin is demanding is a, or what he's projecting as being Russia's war aims in relation to Ukraine is the consensus of Russian society. Now, Putin is articulating what most people in Russia want to see happen. They want to see a compromise, a peace. They want to make territorial gains which are necessary for Russia's security, but they don't want to see Ukraine to be destroyed. No, they want the war to end. They want the slaughter to end. The slaughter on their own side, but also the slaughter on Ukraine's side. So what Putin's peace plan, if you could call it that, peace proposal, very much reflects the the consensus among Russian society, Russian people, the Russian elite, as to what Russia is trying to achieve in this war. Now, in spelling this out, Putin is actually rebuffing hardline elements in Russian society who want to go a lot further. There are plenty of people in Russia who say that we shouldn't stop at Zaporozhye, Kherson, the Donbass. We should occupy all of Ukrainian territory up to Dnieper, up to the eastern bank of the Dnieper. At least we should capture Kharkov. We should take control of Odessa. And what Putin basically has signaled in this speech with his proposals that he is prepared to face down his own hardliners and say, no, this is this is what we want to achieve. The demands are limited and moderate. So it's actually it's a very kind of like moderate proposal, and also proposals about as favorable as Ukraine can expect, because if Putin's offer, I mean, it's already been rejected, but if by Ukraine and the West, but if it remains rejected, then all that's going to happen is that the war is going to continue. Russia is going to achieve its territorial goals anyway. In the meantime, many tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians are going to be killed, and much more of Ukrainian society is going to be going to be destroyed. And so and the whole of Ukraine's future as an independent sovereign state is going to be called into question. So what Putin is offering Ukraine, Ukrainian people, is a way out of this of this terrible of this terrible situation that they are facing. I think the other important point to know about this speech is that it's I you know it's very much the mess. Okay, the when Putin makes a speech like this, big speech, he's addressing many different audiences, and it contains many different messages. So there are these like signals and messages to the Russian domestic situation, is that this is what we're fighting this war for at a minimum, and this is what we want to achieve, this is what we're going to achieve. But I think the speech and proposal are also aimed at Ukraine and the Ukrainian people, because I have a feeling that Putin has given up on any prospect of the West being willing to negotiate and enter this conflict. I think he's concluded that they're not going to do it. They're going to fight to the last Ukrainian. But he does see a possibility that the Ukrainians themselves might choose to make peace with Russia. Russia, not Zelensky and his regime, but perhaps or some kind of post-Zelensky regime, right? And what he and what he's telling the Ukrainians and any post-Zelensky government is that this is what they can expect if they want to it to, if they want to make peace, right? And the other thing he's saying is, and this is a really important point in the speech, which I think has been overlooked in the commentary on, is that Putin says, well, look, if Ukraine agrees to our conditions, if they agree to concede this additional territory to us in Zaporozhye, in Kherson, and in the Donbass, well, cede it voluntarily rather than us having to capture it, and if they start to withdraw their forces from these territories which they've conceded to Russia, then we will guarantee the safe and secure withdrawal of the Ukrainian military forces, right? That's a very important point, because one of the problems they have on the Ukrainian side about calling for a ceasefire or entering into negotiations or going down the path of peace is that by doing that, they might precipitate a really drastic collapse in morale on their side among their troops, and their whole front might collapse as a result of trying to negotiate some kind of peace. So what Putin says is that doesn't have to happen. You can withdraw in good order, you can keep what's remaining of your forces intact, and that will give you a stable position to control the situation inside Ukraine, because there's sure to be opposition to any peace deal with Russia, perhaps violent opposition, and also some basis for actually conducting a serious negotiation in which, okay, Russia will have a lot of demands, but it will also it will also be prepared to make some concessions. So Putin is putting forward a practical way out on Ukraine side if they want to pursue the path of peace. I think that's a very important point. And there's one final point to make in relation to that, is that in doing this, Putin is taking a risk. There are risks on the Russian side as well as the Ukrainian side, because of course the risk is, well, the Ukrainians might accept this deal. A new regime in Ukraine might accept this deal, do what Putin asked. They may withdraw their forces, but there's no re there's no you know, there's nothing to guarantee that any the people who did that, Ukraine, the new Ukraine leadership did that, they won't be overthrown by some internal coup, perhaps backed up by the West, and then start to walk back from these ceasefire commitments. So there's a certain amount of risk involved in this peace proposal for the Russian side, as well as, of course, for the Ukrainian side.
Yeah, I think what makes these preconditions much practical would be he wanted to build on those agreements in Istanbul. He was saying the basis, the foundation would be those agreements in Istanbul. That would bring some sort of sanity to these type of negotiations, in my opinion. How do you see, and at the same time, he said that as time goes by, these conditions are so fluid that they may change. This is the very important point right now that we are living, we are witnessing right now. I think it's so important for the future of Ukraine.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, obviously, what Putin is proposing now is very much an extension of the negotiations and the position that Russia took in Istanbul in the spring of 2022. But look, things have moved on a lot since then. And really, the real starting point for his peace proposal is what happened in October 2022, when Zaporozhye, Lugansk, Donetsk, and Kherson were all formally incorporated into the Russian Federation, became part of Russia, constitutionally incorporated. And Putin said at times that that's a done deal. That those territories who are part of Russia, which of course they became part of Russia following referendums in each of those provinces. They're part of Russia forever. There will be no negotiation about that. Now, there was a certain amount of ambiguity as to where the precise boundaries of this newly incorporated territories of Russia were, particularly in relation to Zaporozhye and Kherson. But that's the one thing that Putin has clarified. In this latest set of proposals, he's clarified that the boundaries of Kherson and Zaporozhye, as far as he's concerned and as far as Russia's concerned, in terms of the constitutional position, do include the two capitals of these provinces, which are currently remaining Ukrainian hands: Kherson City, which of course the Russians withdrew from at the end of 2022, and Zaporozhye City. So that's Putin's demand that the Ukrainians cede Kherson City and Zaporozhye is what you might call the most radical part of his demand. The demand that they concede what remains in their hands of the Donbas is not so radical, because it's quite clear that Russian military force is going to occupy that territory in the next few weeks or so. Anyway, so that is quite a significant position that Putin has laid out, and you could kind of see it as being his one concession to Russian hardliners. Okay, we're not going to strive to capture Odessa and Kharkov, but yeah, we are determined to gain the two capitals of these two new provinces of Russia, as part of our war aims. Yeah. Now the question of what happens next, is that Putin also said, of course, he basically said this, which, okay, this is the offer as of now, but if the offer is spurned, the war will continue, and as the military realities on the ground continue, then obviously, what the Ukrainians could expect in terms of losses, demands placed on them, that they would change as well. Now, he didn't spell it out, but obviously what he's pointing towards is that Russian territorial aspirations will grow, if only as a result of military exigency. Yeah, if Ukraine is not is going to keep fighting the war with Western support, then Russia is going to have to take certain steps to actually to defeat Ukraine military, but also then but also to safeguard its security situation in the post-war period, in the post-war situation. So what does that mean? That means further Russian expansion into southern and eastern Ukraine, perhaps all the way up to the Dnieper River, perhaps capturing Kharkov, perhaps taking control of Odessa as well. What happens then? Well, maybe they won't be immediately incorporated into the Russian Federation, like Zaporozhye, Kherson, and Donbass were. They would become part of some kind of like Russian security zone, something like that. But of course, the implication is that as time goes by, there could well be moves to hold referendums in these additionally captured territories from Ukraine. And if the referendums run the right way, then they could be incorporated into the Russian Federation. So that's what Putin is. That's Putin's message to Ukrainians. Yeah, this is a deal. Okay, you're going to lose a lot of territory as a result of this deal. That's for sure. But you're going to lose a hell of a lot more, and your country is going to be end up in a much weaker position if you don't if you don't decide to grasp this nettle of negotiations. Now, notwithstanding all the difficulties that it's going to create for the Ukrainian side. But there's another point about that. I mean, I said earlier that okay, in Russia there is this consensus in favor of a compromise peace with Ukraine, and Putin and his proposals, I think, has captured the essence of what that compromise peace would look like from the Russian point of view. But I also think on the Ukrainian side, there's more and more evidence of all kinds coming out that there's a compromise peace consensus growing in among Ukrainian people as well. Okay, they don't want to give up any of this territory, but they're prepared to do it for the sake of peace. So I think that's the other kind of like message that Putin is trying to get across as part of this speech. He's speaking directly to the Ukrainian people. The Ukrainian people, of course, all of them can understand Russian. All of them are capable, and lots of them do, of listening or to what Putin says or reading what he says. He's saying to them, look, you don't, okay. You lose the war, you're going to take losses, but you don't have to fear total extinction. That is not my aim. That is not Russia's aim. Our aims are actually relatively modest. Okay, not very pleasant for you, a very bitter pill for you to swallow, but life can go on, your country can go on, yeah, and recover and prosper, and also we, develop a good relationship with Russia if it should choose to do so.
He didn't talk about Odessa, Nikolaev, these cities that are so important for Ukrainians and for Russians, both of them. And he just opened to negotiate. He's just there. Just these are preconditions. These are not about peace talks.
Well, I think the preconditions are realistic in purely kind of practical terms, in theoretical terms, if you like. The blockage is a political one, on the Western side and on the Ukraine side. Yeah, on the Western side, they're not prepared to accept defeat by Russia and all the consequences that will flow from that. They're not prepared to accept the huge loss of political face that they're going to lose, the decline in their global prestige, the further development of the crumbling of their global hegemony. They're not prepared to accept that. They're just going to like play this game out for as long as they can. And the same thing is true on the Ukrainian side, is that Zelensky and his regime are not prepared politically to accept these terms, because of course it will mean the end of their regime, their power, their position. But I think Putin, I'm not saying he's calculating on it, but I think Putin is hoping is that there are elements within the Ukrainian elite and within the Ukrainian military, obviously very important, that would be prepared to negotiate on the terms of the preconditions that he set out. Now, clearly they're not ready to do that at the moment, but I don't know. Perhaps sooner than one might expect. If it start, I mean, it's going very badly for Ukraine on the battlefield at the moment. If it starts going disastrously badly, at that point, more realistic, more pragmatic elements on the Ukrainian side might be willing to make a move to get rid of Zelensky and to actually and actually negotiate a peace with Russia. And Putin has given them the framework and a possibility that I think makes that feasible. And that was very important to do because until he made this speech, there was a lot of ambiguity as to exactly what Russia's war aims were and how far Putin wanted to go, was prepared to go. Putin's spelled out what the situation is. I think the other point to make about the speech, very important point as well. Okay, so it had a there were messages to the Russian domestic audience. There's messages to the Ukrainian audience. I think the message to the West is almost, we don't care what you think anymore. But there's also a very, very important message from Putin and from Russia to the Global South, isn't there? And the message is that, if the Ukrainian war drags on, it won't be because of Russia or because of Putin. And I think that's a message, and this is what we're prepared to settle for, which I repeat. Okay, depends on your point of view, but looked at in any kind of dispassionate way, it's actually quite a moderate basis for a peace settlement between Russia and Ukraine. But Putin's, I think, given Global South countries a platform for which they can continue their diplomacy, their efforts, their lobbying, yeah, their pressure to actually create a situation in conditions under which there can be a ceasefire, the war can come to an end, and there can be some kind of lasting peace settlement.
Yeah. When it comes to the summit in Switzerland, we know that Zelensky's peace plan contains 10 points, but out of these 10 points, they were discussing just 3 points in the final declaration. It was talking about the control of Zaporizhzhia power plant and the exchange of prisoners and the ports, the trades, and these are why they decided to talk about just 3 points in his peace plan. That was the influence coming from the Putin's preconditions before the summit, or something else was going on in the summit.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of origins of this the Switzerland Peace Conference was that I think it was over late 2022 or early 23 when Zelensky first put forward his 10-point peace plan, which is basically it was what the 10-point peace plan amounted to was that Russia should accept defeat, yes, and withdraw its forces, not just from post 14 Ukraine, but also from Crimea as well. So in pursuit of that project, and it's okay, it's very much a propaganda project, of course. There's these series of peace conferences held based on Zelensky's 10-point plan. Conferences which have become successively less important and more unsuccessful. And they, the climax has been this recent one in Switzerland, which has turned out to be a complete failure. And I very much doubt whether there'll be any successor to this peace conference, right? So something that the original idea was like was to build up diplomatic support, particularly, of course, among global South countries for the Ukrainian Western position on the war and their terms on which, that they wanted the war to be settled, the conflict to be settled, i.e., the terms of a defeat, a massive defeat for Russia. That was their position, right? But that campaign, that project has failed. So we end up with this conference where they're discussing, as you say, these 3 points, which is what was about food security, the nuclear issue, particularly the power station, and then the third one was about abductions, yes, of children and deportations and that kind of thing. And it came up with a very kind of anodyne statement at the end, which, okay, a lot of countries did sign it, but including countries like I think Serbia and Hungary, who have been persistent critics of the Ukrainian and Western position in relation to the war, and many other countries which did it without a great deal of enthusiasm. But of course, China didn't even bother to attend the conference. No, none of the BRICS countries who did, they sent low-level representatives. Brazil, for example, none of the BRICS countries, Brazil, South Africa, Saudi Arabia, none of them signed the final this communique with these. With these concerning these the 3 points, and they were joined by a number of other countries as well: Colombia, Mexico, United Arab Emirates, who they didn't attend at all, did they? Armenia, I think I saw Armenia on the list of countries that signed, which I was quite surprised by, given the recent deterioration in Russian-Armenian relations. So a complete. An utter failure. It meant to be the culmination of a long-term propaganda battle and strategy to bolster up the Ukrainian position in terms of world politics, and the result has been actually completely the opposite. And of course, Putin's speech very much upstaged what happened in the discussions in Switzerland. But so yeah, I'm sure. The timing of Putin's speech had a propaganda element to it, but I don't think that means that it wasn't sincere. Obviously Putin's always making propaganda in his speeches, as all politicians do. But no, but I think more important about that is that it's a genuine kind of, it's a genuine offer. Now, having said that, I doubt that Putin had any faith, if any, very little, if any, faith that the offer was going to be taken up. But I think, as I said earlier, maybe the hope is that he's sowing the seed for a future post-Zelensky regime in Kiev that will be willing to accept a ceasefire on the basis of Putin's terms. And for also maybe Putin's got his eye on what's going on in the domestic politics of various European countries. Because of course, yeah, there is this huge kind of political blockage to the West ending its proxy war with Russia in Ukraine and pursuing the path of diplomacy. And it's very difficult to see that that political situation being unblocked. Very difficult, very, very difficult to see that. But that's when you're talking about the current set of politicians, of political leaders in the West. And there's a number of changes which seem to be impending among that political leadership, and in terms of the political situation in different countries, in France, for example, in Britain, and of course in the United States itself, in November, when there's the presidential. So maybe Putin's also got an eye on a radical change in Western politics in the not too distant future, right? And he's positioning himself to appeal to the less ideological and more pragmatic political elements within various Western countries, which, as I say, might in the near future actually come more to the fore politically in those countries than they have been for the last couple of years or so.
Yeah. Do you think that in the European Union, in the United States, they're thinking of the continuation of this war, no matter what Putin's what's the Putin's attitude, what are these conditions that Russia is asking for. Because today we've learned right after these preconditions, Lloyd Austin said Putin has no right to do that. This is amazing that you call one of the countries who are in this conflict, the main country, you say they have no right to do that. I don't know who else gonna have the right to do anything in Ukraine. And today, just the White House spokesman John Kirby says that Ukraine has to win the war with Russia to join NATO. These are hugely dangerous rhetorics that are coming out right now. We know that recently they were talking about using the bases in Romania and Poland attacking Russia. Russia said these type of rhetorics would make these bases in Europe a legitimate target for Russia. Do you think that we are, instead of getting out of this summit in Switzerland and these preconditions, have a more political way of thinking of the conflict in Ukraine? It seems that we are on the path of getting more escalations. How do you find the current situation right now?
Well, I mean, Kirby's statement that Ukraine can't become a member of NATO until it's won the war with Russia, it's effectively a statement that Ukraine's never going to be a member of NATO because, okay, anything's possible. But one thing is not possible is that Ukraine is not going to win this war. And I would say I would say also it's certain that Russia is going to win the war, one way or the other. The only thing that might actually preclude that happening is if you get some kind of like really terrible escalation, which leads the whole world, getting blown up, and then there will be no victory. But I think even in the most ideologically driven Western politicians, there's a realization or a dawning realization that there's no hope of a Ukrainian victory, that Ukraine's going to be defeated, the Western Brexit war is going to be defeated, Russia is going to win. But they dug themselves into a rhetorical hole whereby, if they turn around and start behaving pragmatically and realistically and start making hard compromises and talking to Russia, talking to Putin, actually negotiate with them, is that their whole kind of like political position is going to collapse. They're going to be completely discredited, in terms of all their past statements would have been nullified. Now, maybe at a certain point, when we get closer to the end, then they might come to the conclusion that, well, okay, our political position is going to be destroyed anyway by the actual outcome of the war. So maybe it would be better if we try to retrieve something now by bringing it to an end as soon as possible. But I don't know. I mean, all the indications are is that they're just gonna just spit it out. They're just gonna spin it out and see what happens. Hope it turns out better than they expected. And I'm kind of coming to the view myself that the only hope of the war coming to an end in the near future is if the Ukrainians themselves decide to do something, or something happens in Ukraine, there's some development there which opens up the possibility of peace. I just don't see any evidence that something's going to happen in the West that's going to lead very quickly anyway to any kind of ceasefire or negotiations or peace, unless of course there's some really quite dramatic changes in Western domestic political situation, which brings to power new leaders who are willing to undertake a new course in relation to Ukraine, and they're able to do that because of course they aren't tainted with the past positions. Yeah, they might be in opposition, and in some cases they would have been part of a bipartisan position in relation to taking the hard line on Russia in relation to the Ukrainian war. But they wouldn't have been the ones in government taking the decisions. Yeah. So politically, that it'd be much more easy for them to reverse course or change course, right? And accept the political flak that's going to result from the defeat of the West's proxy war of Russia in Ukraine.
If Ukrainians come to a decision that it would be better for them to go after negotiations, that would be reflected in the Zelensky administration, or as long as Zelensky is in power and these people are in power, is not even possible to think of it.
Well, I mean, Putin and the Russians, so they made it quite clear that they don't think there's any possibility of doing any deal with Zelensky or his regime. I don't think that's completely to be ruled out, because of course you may recall that as a result of the events in Ukraine in 2014, a government came to power that the Russians considered to be an illegitimate government in Kiev, and also proceeded with presidential elections, which the Russians considered to be unconstitutional, and the election of a president, which they didn't think was legally valid. But nevertheless, in the end, they accepted the post 2014 regime in Kiev, and they also accepted, the new president that was elected, Poroshenko, dealt with him and negotiated with him, and of course, so I wouldn't entirely rule out Moscow being willing to engage with the current Kiev regime, but I have to say I find it very difficult to see Zelensky and his regime actually. Actually engaging in serious peace negotiations with Moscow. So I think it has to be a post-Zelensky regime situation is what we're talking about now. How that can happen again, it's difficult to say, because okay, there might be elements in the elite, sure there are, and among the military, you might want to get rid of Zelensky, install a new regime, and actually accept Putin's preconditions for a ceasefire. But how do they do that? How do they come to power without actually splitting themselves, right, in such a way that Ukraine will be fatally weakened, and the morale of its armed forces would collapse, and the Russians would be able to roll over and do anything what they want. So it's a very, very, it's a very, very difficult call to make. But I think, the worse the military situation gets, the more likely it is that there will be some anti-Zelensky move to overthrow him in some form, right? Because it will become, the risk of that will be outweighed by the risks of allowing the military situation to continue, the war to continue in the direction that is going on. Of course, the West could play a constructive role here. I mean, the West could actually facilitate getting rid of Zelensky, and doing it in such a way that the whole of Ukrainian politics is on, is not like fractured by what happened. So there's so you know there is regime change, but there's also the maintenance of some kind of stability, some kind of law and order. But again, I see no evidence that the current crop of Western politicians are willing to act in that responsible in that responsible way, because all they've got is their own political interests at heart, the Western position. Yeah, they say they care about Ukraine and its people. Maybe they believe it themselves. Maybe they feel it themselves. But actually, their actions speak otherwise. What their actions say, tell us, is that they don't care about Ukraine and the Ukrainian people. All they care about is themselves, their politics, and their and their states and societies.
What they're doing right now in Ukraine is a function of what they're receiving from the West, because they're receiving weapons and they're receiving aids from the West. That's why they have to follow the orders that coming from the West. It seems that in the West they didn't come to a conclusion that the conflict in Ukraine has to come to an end, to a peaceful end, to a some sort of political settlement.
Yeah, look, it's been true since the very beginning of the war is that the war has only continued because of Western support for Ukraine, and because the West decided to fight a proxy war with Russia in Ukraine and through the Ukrainian armed forces. Without Western support to Ukraine, this war would have been over months ago, years ago, in fact. And it's only Western support that's keeping the Ukrainian side of the war go. If that was terminated, the war would end very quickly, indeed, because the Ukraine wouldn't be now positioned to continue to fight. They'd have no choice but to actually accept Putin's Putin free conditions for a for a for a, for a, for a ceasefire. Okay, so but there's no sign that the West is going to discontinue its aid anytime soon. The aid will continue to flow into Ukraine. But look, but the aid program is running into lots of problems. The weapon supplies have dwindled, to a trickle, and it doesn't seem that there's going to be any significant increase in the weapons flow into Ukraine into the near future. Certainly, there's going to be no resumption of the massive supplies of weaponry that the West was able to supply Ukraine with in 22 and 20 and 23, for the simple reason that the weaponry is not available. But I'm saying the money's still there, the finance still there, but that's running into the problems as well, because of course Ukraine's financial and economic needs are just growing exponentially. Hundreds of billions of dollars every year are now required to keep Ukraine going. And there are signs of even Western financial largesse is running up to its limits, which is why, of course, some people in the West have been so keen to actually steal Russian foreign assets and transfer those to the Ukraine, because the West itself doesn't have the money, or it has the money, but it doesn't want to give it to Ukraine. Okay, but the fundamental problem is this. The fundamental problem is that the Western support will continue at whatever levels they can supply, and that will keep the war going. But the most fundamental problem is that Ukraine is running out of soldiers. It's running out of people that it can send to the front line to be killed by the Russians. That's the factor that I think is going to, irrespective of how much money or how much weaponry the West throws at the Ukrainians, right? And how much they support Zelensky, and they continue sanctions with Russia and all that kind of thing. In the end, Ukraine is going to run out of people with which to fight the war. And I just hope that we don't actually get to the point where they have no more people with which to fight the war in effect, in practical terms. Because if we get to that point, we're at a point of absolute disaster for the future of the Ukrainian people and for the future of Ukraine as an independent state.
How did you find the recent elections in the European Union, and how influential would that be for the policy in Ukraine in the future, in your opinion?
Well, of course, it's a point that bears repeating, is that European public opinion in different countries in Europe, certainly in Western Europe, maybe not so much in places like Poland, well, not in Poland, well, actually even in Poland, maybe not in the Baltic States, but across Europe, European public opinion wants the war to end. They want it. I'm sure European public opinion as a whole be perfectly happy to sign up to Putin's preconditions if it brought about a ceasefire, if it ended the slaughter, and it led to some lasting lasting last lasting peace settlement. And I think the recent European elections reflected that public opinion. Those parties which are have some kind of at least some degree of critical distance from the Western position on the Ukraine war, and are critical of at least some aspects of the West proxy war with Russia and Ukraine. Those are the parties and movements that have done relatively well in the European elections. The European Parliament was a very, very, I would say, Russo as a whole, collectively Russophobic body. Very, very hawkish when it came to support for Ukraine and for prosecuting the war in Ukraine. I mean, that body is going to be a much, much more diverse body in terms of its political opinion. And of course, there are developments in particular countries which point in the direction of changes in politics, perhaps changes in political regime that's going to be more conducive to the West deciding to pursue a diplomatic struggle, a strategy in relation to the Ukraine war, rather than a militaristic military strategy. So I think in a general sense, the outcome of the European elections were good from the pro-peace point of view, from the point of view of those of us who want the war to come to an end as soon as possible.
Yeah. Do you think these results show that the people are shifting to the right-wing parties, or they are looking for some sort of alternative for the current policies in the European Union?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how much meaning these kind of like concepts of right, left, and centre have these days. I think people have very diverse identities and political preferences and outlooks. And they search around for politicians or political parties that best express what they're trying to say when they cast their vote, right? And quite often, they do end up voting for parties that would be, in traditional terms, classified as far right. But I don't think that means that the voters themselves are far right. I think it means they're looking for some party or politician who's going to try and do something different, who's going to listen to them, who's going to address their concerns, make an actual change. So I don't, yeah, obviously parties categorized as far right have actually done quite well out of these European elections. But also, there's other parties that have done quite well as well. Obviously in Germany, it's not just the Alternative for Germany that did quite well in European elections. The left-wing alternatives have also, Sarah Wagenknecht, her kind of movement has also gained representation in European Parliament. And of course, Sarah Wagenknecht and her movement, very, very critical of the German government in relation to the Ukraine war, very, very pro-peace, pro-peace position.
The other problem would be the other question would be, how much of these changes that are happening right now, we know that people in the European Union are not happy with the current situation in their own countries, but how much of these disagreements, these dissatisfaction comes from the conflict in Ukraine directly or indirectly?
Well, of course, the okay, it's the war itself. that issue. But of course, there's been all kinds of, negative kind of spin-offs for the war as far as European countries are concerned. In terms of energy prices, economic problems of all kinds, inflation. There's all this kind of like resources being devoted to propping up Ukraine and supplying them with armaments and so on. Obviously, people are saying, well, shouldn't we be using those resources, for other purposes? And also, I think there is, there is a concern, maybe not as big a concern as one might have expected, actually, but certainly a level of concern about, where this war in Ukraine is going. A concern about the danger of escalation, escalation. A concern that, it could expand. And he brought a number of countries in a catastrophic crash of conflict. So I don't think the Ukrainian issue, the war and peace issue in relation to Ukraine, is in political terms, is the most important item on people's agendas when they're going to vote. But I think it would have been an important factor there. And I think those who have got a more nuanced or at least if not a critical position in relation to what's going on in Ukraine, Western support for Ukraine in the Western proxy war with Russia, I think those elements would have gained some support as a result of their position, at least in some countries and in some circumstances.
Yeah. The other thing would be the new reports show how dependent we talk about Germany that they wanted to fight Russia by 2029. But recently we've learned that the Russian fertilizers imported to Germany has been increasing by 9.2 times during these 2 years of conflict. This shows how important Russia is for the European Union, especially for Germany. In Spain, they're talking about iron and steel. After 3 months, they have started importing iron and steel. And the Financial Times reported that Russia overtook the United States in gas supplies to the European Union in May. These all together show how important Russia is for Europe.
I read that Financial Times story as well. Yeah, that Russian gas imports into Europe, both pipeline and LNG imports here, have actually increased. And I think you're right. And they've actually overtaken those of the United States. Yeah, they're still okay. There's LNG gas being shipped into Germany and other European countries, but there's also gas flowing through the Ukraine's pipelines to the West. Yeah, still flowing, and the Russians are still paying Ukrainians fees for that facility. It's, despite the fact that there is this war. The war going on. Okay, and it goes back to what we started up discussing, which was Putin's peace terms here, is that okay, so these preconditions for negotiations, but then there can be negotiation of a detailed peace term, which involve very different elements. I think one of the most important of which would be an international security guarantee for Ukraine, various protections for both Russians and Ukrainians. In the different territories, all kinds of, but also the whole issue of Ukraine's post-war economic reconstruction, and I think this is a sphere in which the Russians, I think as part of the deal, and also because it, I think, it would serve their purposes as well, will be willing to lend considerable aid to Ukraine's post-war reconstruction. And one example of the way that could work is that obviously Ukraine could start shipping more gas through to Western Europe and get paid for it. But also the Russians themselves could guarantee cheap energy supplies for Ukraine. Another example would be, of course, one of the the things the Russians have been doing as part of their military campaign is the so-called electricity war. That's to say, they've been destroying Ukraine's energy infrastructure in terms of power stations and stuff like and stuff like that. Well, this energy infrastructure is mainly a heritage from the Soviet era, right? And when it comes to rebuilding their energy infrastructure in a post-war situation, it's Russia that has the spare parts and has the expertise to actually to aid that process. So there's all kinds of ways in which, Ukraine's going to have to give up a lot of territory to secure peace. I'm not sure how you count it out, but you're talking about something like 20% of its territory, right? In order to get a ceasefire and to get to the negotiating table. But once they're at the negotiating table, there are lots of very positive things, concessions that they can extract from Russians with Western backing, with the West, using its power in terms of sanctions, not to try to destroy Russia, but to as an incentive, as a pressure on Russia to actually make what concessions it can to Ukraine, in economic and in other terms. Yeah.
Just to wrap up this session, do you think Europeans would wait for any sort of political change in the United States to come to some sort of sanity about Ukraine and the conflict in Ukraine? Oh, they're gonna make their minds before that.
Well, I mean that of course that's the last hope of Europe's current corporate politicians. I said they're like, they're spitting it out. They're hoping something's going to turn up, but it's not going to be as bad as it might possibly be. Yeah, obviously their last final kind of like redoubt of hope is that Biden is going to win, the presidential election in November. I have to say, I think. If he doesn't win the presidential election in November, the war's still going on, and Trump gets in. Who knows what Trump is going to do? But I think at that point, that's the point at which the European position in relation to campaign and pursuing this proxy war with Russia and this support. I think that's the point at which that support will crumble, and the Western position will shift. Will shift very, 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 very dramatic. But certainly, the game will definitely, whatever the game will be up, will be up for them. So in a way, I mean, that's probably the ultimate thing that's keeping the war going in terms of European support and bolstering for Ukraine. Is this hope, which seems to be a dwindling hope, going by the opinion polls that Biden is going to be returned to office in November.